This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:22 p.m. Tuesday, March 31st, 2026 in Davis 106. Members present are Representatives Ruffridge, Mears, Prox, Gray, and myself, Representative Mina Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Andrew Giannotti, our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Kyla Tupo, our LAO moderator, and Katie Giorgio, my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. We have three items on today's agenda. The first is House Bill 157, Effect of Adoption Decree on Siblings. This is the initial hearing of this bill by Representative Andrew Gray. I will ask Representative Gray and his staff, Rosie Coet, to come up to the presenter's table, put yourself on the record, and please begin your bill presentation.
Thank you, Chair Mina, and members of the House Social Services Committee. Sibling relationships are among the most powerful and enduring connections a person can have. For most people, their brother or sister, the relationship they have with their brother or sister is the longest relationship they will have in their lifetime. Longer than the relationship with their parents, longer than the relationship with their own children, longer than the relationship with their spouses or their friends. It is the relationship that you have your entire life. For children in foster care, siblings are often a remaining link to their past, their identity, and their family. These bonds provide emotional stability, comfort, and a sense of belonging during an experience that is often confusing and traumatic. American Academy of Pediatrics notes that family separation, quote, can cause irreparable harm, disrupting a child's brain architecture and affecting his or her short and long-term health, end quote. When siblings are placed apart in foster care, many never receive regular visits or contact with one another. Siblings who maintain contact experience greater feelings of safety, fewer emotional and behavioral challenges, stronger peer relationships, and better school performance. Under current Alaska law, adoption ends the legal relationship between adopted children and their birth family, including siblings. HB 157 preserves legal sibling relationships and encourages adoptive families to maintain these vital connections. I will now ask my staff, Rosie Coet, to walk you through the sectional, if that is the will of the chair.
Yes, please continue with the sectional, Ms. Coet.
Thank you, Chair Mina and members of the committee. I will now read through the sectional analysis. Section 1 clarifies that the legal relationship between an adopted person and that person's siblings is not terminated as a result of an adoption decree. Section 2 requires the court to determine whether post-adoption visitation with a foster child's siblings is in the child's best interest and to document that determination in the final adoption decree. Section 3 clarifies that when an adoption decree terminates the legal relationship between an adopted person and the person's biological parents or relatives, the decree does not terminate the legal relationship between the adopted person and the person's siblings. Section 4 defines a sibling as a person who, one, is related to an individual by blood, adoption, or marriage as a child of one or both parents, or was raised together with an individual in the same household for a period of time and in the same manner as children related by blood, adoption, or marriage. Section 5 provides that the act takes effect immediately. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coet. And for the record, I want to note that Representatives Field and Schwanke joined us at 3:25 p.m. I know there's a bit of a time crunch for some members, so I would like to see if any members who have to leave early have any questions for the presenter. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you guys for bringing this bill forward. Certainly think on its face it is a very important issue and something that we should be discussing. My biggest question is it seems like Section 3 grants sort of an unending and sort of irrevocable right for a sibling to be connected to the adoptee sort of no matter what. In some cases, I think the court would like to find that potentially a sibling is not a safe person. What is the option to sort of maybe move around this in the case that a termination might be in that child's best interest?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. The purpose of the bill is at the adoption proceeding. If it's in the best interest of the child to maintain the relationship, that is stated on the record. But there's nothing in the bill that mandates any type of visitation, phone calls, contact whatsoever between siblings after adoption if the adoptive parents don't want it. So the bill is not mandating any type of contact. So I guess to answer your question more bluntly, if the adoptive parent believes that it's not in the best interest for the child to maintain contact with their siblings, the adoptive parent does not have to allow that contact to occur.
Okay, follow, Madam Chair. So I guess then that brings me to a whole different set of questions then about this specific language. If the intent is to ensure that the relationship in most cases is retained, I believe that can happen now under that court proceeding. Mm-hmm. I was reading this as sort of this is the default mandate, which is you can terminate. And I guess a parental right is way different than a sibling right. Mm-hmm. That there is really no sibling right. Mm-hmm. I was reading this as an intention to create a sibling right. And is that incorrect?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. This bill does not, as you'll hear from our invited testifiers, the symbolic dissolution of legal sibling relationships is something that really bothers foster kids when they're adopted. So what this bill does is maintain that legal relationship. I think the invited testimony speaks very powerfully to the need to maintain that legal relationship. But what we didn't want to do is we did not want to add additional duties to OCS, which is already overburdened, to say that you have to somehow check and see if these kids that have been adopted and are no longer part of OCS custody are maintaining their relationships. So we were very careful to make sure that we didn't add unfunded mandates to OCS about additional duties that would be required of them. So that's why the bill does not mandate it. I do think for many adoptive parents, hearing the judge say this child has existing sibling relationships that this court believes would be in the best interest for that child to maintain would carry weight and would encourage adoptive parents to maintain that contact when it's appropriate.
Yeah, follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Certainly don't disagree with that. I guess maybe the follow up question to that is there an actual legal relationship between a sibling, between siblings post, is there a legal relationship between siblings? That's the question.
Through the chair, that's a great question for a lawyer.
Yeah.
I will say that we do not have a lawyer as invited testimony today.
Okay.
I don't know if we have a lawyer in the room who can answer what, but. But we do, I will say that we've had some lawyers talk about inheritance and how that is something that this bill would affect perhaps in the event that a legal sibling had property and passed away and then your legal sibling would inherit it. But perhaps I speak too much.
Well, that would be up to the chair, through the chair, if it's really up to you. That would just be – that's the extent of my questions, really, and they'd really come based around that sort of legal relationship. So whenever it's convenient for you to answer that question, that would be great.
Thank you. My understanding is that some members may have to leave just about now, so if there's any other members that have to leave early but wanted to ask a question, and we will be returning to this bill on Thursday as well.
Thank you.
Eddie's? Back on the record, looks like we have a little bit of time to flex, so we will now turn to our invited testifiers. First, I would like to call up Maddie Brewer, calling in from Anchorage. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good For the record, my name is Madison Doerr, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 157. For the majority of my life, what has defined me was being an older sister. As the second oldest out of eight, I've always had a lot of responsibilities on my shoulders, although it wasn't always too bad. They followed in line like little ducklings, always safe as long as they followed behind. But I did also take on the brunt of the work extremely young, so our dysfunctional household could run. And as things that run partially broken, it's only a matter of time before it's unrepairable. It's crazy how childhood magic can change a negative situation to a positive one, especially when they have a sister who learns early how to distract and protect them the best that she could. How bad things truly are once sees to scare them from the monster lurking in the dark. And although I am now grown and living on my own and living my own life, it has taken a lot of work to get to the point where they're not in the forefront of my mind. Living so long that way, I honestly think I will always have a part of me like this, the anxiety and stress a parent would have, or parents should have had, but instead it was me. Now I have five of my siblings split up between three homes soon to be adopted. Everything safe and comfortable was ripped away, and even this, if things don't change. It was devastating to go back into care when I had finally left for a trip right before. I had finally learned how to appreciate my siblings and how special and lucky I was to have them, just to have them ripped away. I wasn't going to talk about my feelings with any of them, but then my sister came to me when she came to my house and started bawling, and I realized it wasn't just me. This is my sister who lives at a home alone, and it was awful because there was not a thing that I could do. I could comfort her, yes, but how do I say that it'll be fine when she's already isolated from all of us? My other two little sisters still bawl when I'm in there, or when my foster mom leaves, saying, "Please don't leave," looking up the entire way. All of my siblings range from 19 to 6. My siblings need to know me. When I was first back in care, I was the only one that could get them down and convince them to eat. I already know my sister couldn't stand for this, the way I had to listen to her helplessly as she cried, "You're the only one who I get to see, and I'm losing that." She already plans on having a room in my hypothetical house, but if she is in a life-threatening situation, I wouldn't be able to be there, and I fear that I would be the only one. I'm helping now, and many more. I'm helping one now through college right now. I had no one there, but my brother gets to learn from my mistakes. I get to see him through it all, and I need to be there just in case he needs. Majority of my siblings, like I said, are about to get adopted. I need to know that I still get to be their sibling. I want them to know me. Not as a sister, not as a stranger or a friend, a sister. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Maddie Brewer, for your testimony and for sharing your story. Next, we have Kilo Stone with Facing Foster Care in Alaska calling from Anchorage. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Kilo Stone. I am testifying in support of House Bill 157. Brothers and sisters share history, memories, and a sense of connection that can be incredibly grounding, especially during big life changes. such as adoption. Adoption is meant to provide stability and love, but that shouldn't come at the cost of losing those lifelong bonds.
Excuse me, Kilo Stone, your audio is a little bit muffled. If you don't mind speaking up a little bit and starting at the beginning of your testimony. Thank you.
Yeah. Is that better?
Yo, that is much better. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, I'll start again. For the record, my name is Keila Stone. I am testifying in support of House Bill 157. Brothers and sisters share history, memories, and a sense of connection that can be incredibly grounding, especially during big life changes, such as adoption. Adoption is meant to provide stability and love, but that shouldn't come at the cost of losing those lifelong bonds. The bill hopefully recognizes how meaningful those relationships are and helps make sure they're protected whenever possible. Sibling connections often grow into vital support systems in adulthood, providing stability, a sense of understanding, and a lasting sense of family. For example, even after being adopted out of state, my siblings still decided to come back to Alaska to be near family, and they currently live with me, and I have guardianship of one. Because it's very important to have those relationships, you know, someone that understands that they've lived through, especially when they're adopted from foster care. Staying connected can support a child's emotional well-being and identity over time, not just in childhood, but throughout their life. I believe House Bill 157 is a step in the right direction for supporting children and honoring the importance of family. So I hope you vote for this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions for any of our invited testifiers? All right. I will now open it up for any questions for the bill sponsor. And I would like to note that we have available for questions Assistant Attorney General Carla Erickson with the Child Protection Division with the Department of Law. At ease. Back on the record, on House Bill 157, we have available for questions Carla Erickson, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Child Protection Division. We also have Kim Swisher, Deputy Director of the Office of Children's Services, as well as Nancy Mead, General Counsel with the Alaska Court System. Representative Ruffridge?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just want to go back to that initial question that I had prior to our invited testimony, and I want to say I had the chance to meet one of our invited testifiers. I think actually many of us did at the KC Family Programs event, and I think their testimony is obviously a big component of ensuring that this is an important issue going forward. I really want to address that legal question, though, and I don't know if that could be directed to one of those individuals online about what legal rights do siblings currently have, and sort of what is, if with this language in here, is it creating a legal right that I guess I just, that's an area I know nothing about.
Representative Ruffridge, I'll defer that question to Deputy Director Kim Swisher with OCS. If you could please answer, put yourself on the record and answer Representative Ruffridge's question.
For the record, this is Deputy Director Kim Swisher. And unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer. I will need to defer this to the Assistant Attorney General, Carla Erickson. I apologize.
Thank you. And Carla Erickson, Chief Assistant Attorney General, would you be able to answer Representative Ruffridge's question?
Through the chair, yes, Chair Mina, to Representative Ruffridge. For the record, Carla Erickson,
Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Child Protection Section of the Department of Law. Yes, in Section 3, it notes specifically that the siblings would remain siblings even after adoption, and normally the adoption is what cuts off all legal relationships to the prior family. And if the siblings remain siblings, then it could impact things like inheritance rights. I don't have the full scope of legal sibling relationships at my disposal outside of a child in need of aid kind of context, so we'd have to look to see if it's any broader than that, what's listed in Section 3. Although I will say it will have impact in the child in need of aid placement preferences after adoption, and this will have the effect of creating essentially a new kind of subset of a preferred placement for children, so that the parents or guardians of a child's sibling, even after adoption, would become first preference placements under both state law and then by extension under the Indian Child Welfare Act, which has a much broader definition of relative to begin with. So those are two areas that come to mind immediately where those ongoing relationships would have ongoing legal impacts.
Follow-up, if I may. I don't want to, sorry, occupy the entire time. Thank you for that answer. That really helps shed some light on sort of the breadth of this bill. If there is a component of this that affects the placement of a child, I guess maybe this is for Ms. Swisher. I had the assumption that those family members were already in first position for placement. So I'm sort of surprised to hear that this would now create that. And maybe it's just not statutorily created. So is that something that we could speak to just briefly?
Deputy Director Swisher.
For the record, this is Deputy Director Swisher, through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. I think we typically, when we get to the adoption stage and termination of parental rights or relinquishment of parental rights has occurred, we have gone through relatives that may be available for permanency. And I think, you know, as I hear from Chief Assistant Attorney General Erickson that this would kind of reopen that question and create a new preference option for us. And so I don't know how to better answer that, and I apologize if I'm fumbling through this, but typically by this stage we would have already exhausted the preference placements, and maybe this adoption would be by a relative, it could be a non-relative, but that would have been something that we would have sorted through prior to the termination of parental rights.
Just another question on that.
Yeah,
thank you. Sorry, I'm struggling to sort of process that in real time. To paraphrase, and maybe if I get this wrong, you can chime in. But let's go down the hypothetical for a second. Let's say an individual is being adopted by an aunt or an uncle, and in that case, the termination decree has some recognition that maybe the full extent of the statute is not taking place. They're not becoming a stranger to that. That person now is becoming, is assuming parental rights. But if that goes forward, and it's a relative, are they still working through a termination of relationships with siblings?
To the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I am going to actually punt this back to my attorney because she is much better at answering these legal questions than I am, but I apologize.
Chief Assistant Attorney General Erickson.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge. You're close. What this if a relative is a relative under 4714-100E, which is the site that this impacts, the definition of an adult family member, is which is the class of individuals that enjoys the highest placement preference, would be a grandma, grandpa, aunt, or uncle, the child's adult sibling, so there's another place where this could have some impact, and also the parent or guardian of the child's sibling. Previously, before this suggested statute change, once a child is adopted, they are no longer siblings, right? So the parent or guardian of that child, of the sibling that had been adopted, is no longer a first placement preference. Now it would remain a first placement preference. And in the case of when we have relatives, it doesn't change much because relatives are always going to be first preference. They stay relatives. And you won't see much difference there in application. Where we might see a significant difference in application is when there has been an adoption by a non-relative, non-family member, in which case now we are those individuals who prior to the adoption could have had no substantive relationship to the biological family of origin will now become a first placement preference on the same level as grandma or grandpa or auntie or uncle or a child's another adult sibling. And that does have some opportunities for impacts. And placement is our most heavily litigated topic in child need of aid proceedings. And so I anticipate that would come up as well.
Okay. Just a brief follow-up. I want to make sure I understand that. Thank you. So what you're saying is if you have an adoption that takes place from a non-biological family, that if that person who is adopted has additional siblings that end up in state custody, the home in which the sibling has been adopted into now becomes the first placement. Did I get that right this time?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, along with the other individuals like grandma and grandpa, aunt or uncle or child's adult sibling. So they'd be on the same par as the biological family relatives for that new child.
Fascinating. All right. Thank you so much.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Fields.
Following up on Representative Ruffridge's earlier question, so if a sibling is kind of on the same priority list as the other relatives, I assume OCS would screen for safety and compatibility with the family in which the sibling is located, just like any other family. Is that right? Probably the bill sponsor knows this a lot better than I, certainly than I do.
I would refer through the chair to Deputy Director Swisher.
Okay.
I don't want to say it wrong.
Deputy Director Swisher, could you answer Representative Fields' question?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, yes, we will be evaluating safety in all homes seeking placement and evaluating safety with any contact between siblings. And I'm sorry if I didn't hear the full question. It was a little bit quiet on my end.
You addressed it through the chair. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can just say to Representative Fields' question, so if a non-family member has adopted a child, they would have been screened.
Sure.
So I think what Deputy Director Swisher is saying is that they would be screened again if they're going to place another child with them.
And I think, Madam Chair, my point is to Representative Ruffridge's earlier point, if there were issues of safety between the siblings at that point of screening, I think OCS would discover it because they screen every home for safety. So hopefully that would be caught if it were an issue. Thank you.
I have a few questions. I think I'll start with the bill sponsor. Looking at the definition of sibling on section 4, so page 3, lines 6 through 11, so I note that there's two different components of sibling. One is biological adoption or by marriage, and the other one is two individuals who are raised together. So could you talk about the definition specifically with subpoint 2, and is that how that's defined in other states that have implemented these types of laws?
Thank you for the question, Chair Mina. We purposely created quite a broad definition of sibling because as the invited testimony stated, in these sort of stressful environments from which these kids come, there's a bonding between the kids, and that bonding would occur whether or not it's a step-sibling, a child in the home, sometimes adopted sibling, another foster kid, that they're in the home together and they are bonded in such a way that it is if they are siblings. So we wanted to create as broad a definition as possible to have this apply to kids who have this deep connection that we think should be preserved. What I'll say about other states, and I'm going to be careful, other states are much more aggressive about this policy than we are in terms of mandating contact between siblings after adoption. We are purposely not. So we did not actually borrow this sibling definition from another state, but we liked the idea of having a broad definition, and that was through talking about this with a lot of foster kids.
Yeah, I definitely understand the intent. I've had cousins that I've spent more time with than other siblings that I've been related to growing up. I'm just trying to figure out how this would work functionally. So I think I'll ask this question to Deputy Director Swisher. How would OCS determine this? How would they determine siblings under this definition of the bill?
Chair Mina, thank you for that question. I think I really would like to defer back to our Attorney General if possible, because this is a legal determination, if you don't mind.
For sure. Chief Assistant Attorney General Erickson.
Thank you, Representative Chair Mina, excuse me. That's actually a fantastic question. There isn't a definition there. There are several phrases there that lend itself to interpretation, and I think in litigation, interpretation means litigation. So, who would those siblings be? What is the definition of a period of time in the same household? What are the factors that we would look at to determine whether or not that sibling should be, that individual should be counted as a sibling such that the other rights attach? And then that will lead into some questions about how that's to be decided, because that amendment is in the adoption statutes and not in the child need of aid statutes. And hopefully we're having the adoption hearing in front of the same judge that had the China hearing, but the parties are not the same either. And so that also brings up questions of how that would get decided. How would that be litigated? In what venue? Under what docket number? That might have implications for rights of intervention for prospective adoptive parents in China cases, which is an area of heavy litigation over the last couple of years. So I can't give you an answer, but I can certainly validate that there are questions there.
Thank you.
Chair Mina, if I can just say, and I'm happy to get advice from Assistant Attorney General Erickson, but you know, the intent of the bill is to encourage adoptive parents to maintain contact with kids that the child they're adopting considers to be their sibling. And it's not to mandate it. It's just to encourage it. So I certainly don't want anything in my bill to create legal uncertainty or lots of litigation. So if there's any suggestions that she has to encourage but not mandate that adopted parents maintain contact between their adopted child and the children that they had spent the most time with growing up, that's what the intent was.
Thank you. I have another question related to the placement priority. I think this is for Chief Assistant Attorney General Erickson. Could you talk about how this bill might impact ICWA?
Yes, for the record, Carla Erickson, Chief Assistant Attorney General, Child Protection. It won't technically, legally change change anything with ICWA and the definitions of extended family member. Sibling is listed, well, let me take a step back. Under state law, the state placement preferences that apply to non-ICWA cases have a very narrow definition of who is in that top tier that I already articulated in response to one of Representative Rufford's questions. ICWA has a much broader definition, but it also includes the words siblings. Because of that, it will arguably bring in that same issue of having what would otherwise be a non-relative family occupying the same priority space as other relatives to that child. And so it doesn't run afoul of ICWA or those definitions. I have some people have articulated a concern that it would run afoul of the spirit of the Indian Child Welfare Act, and I'll leave that for others to decide. But it certainly would bring in that same issue of kind of one step removed from keeping the child attached to that extended family definition under the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I have one more question, and then I'll see if the committee has any additional questions for OCS, particularly on the fiscal note. So my understanding is that the intent of the bill sponsor is to not add more burden onto OCS. It looks like the fiscal note from OCS has a lot of different proposals related to potential need for additional funding, related to permanency and litigation. And so, Deputy Director Swisher, could you talk a bit more about how this bill would impact the office?
Yes, for the record, this is Deputy Director Kim Swisher, to Chair Mina. It's a very good question. I do feel like many of our concerns are outlined in the summary that we provided back for this bill. I think, as Carla Erickson has indicated, I think the concerns for delays, for contested hearings, for questions as the bill is currently written, calls into mind for us added workload. And so I don't know if any of us have a crystal ball of what that would look like, but given as Ms. Erickson described that placement tends to be our most litigated area, that is our concern. And so, as written, we think that it leaves more questions than answers. I think it's the best way to describe that.
And Chief Assistant Attorney General Erickson, did you have any additional commentary?
Thank you, Chairman. I guess I would just add that I also had questions regarding Section 2 of the bill on lines 10 through 15. I would just note that I heard that it wasn't meant to be mandated, but it was to be encouraged. If it is in the best interest, if the court finds it is in the best interest, I have questions about how, is that an enforceable type of thing? Who can enforce it? So I don't know about additional commentary, except I would bring that up. Also, I would bring up that this bill, in general, there are already 3 to 4 definitions of sibling throughout the China statutes that relate to different subsections. This would add another definition and certainly a new application in the way it's currently written. Nothing else. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to re-ask Representative Gray's question about creating more clarity in the bill in order to help alleviate potential litigation and ambiguity. Do you have any recommendations on this legislation, and or would you be able to follow up with the committee on what those recommendations would be?
Yes, of course, Jeremy. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, at this time, we will set aside House Bill 157 for a future hearing. Thank you, Ms. Coette and Representative Gray for your bill hearing. We will take a brief at ease to transition to the next presentation slide. At ease. Back on the record. Our next item on the agenda is the initial hearing for House Bill 344 on Opioid Settlement Fund by Representative Julie Colombe with staff Emily Durfee. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Mina, members of the House and Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, I'm Representative Julie Colombe representing Anchorage Hillside.
I'm Emily Durfee, staff to Representative Colombe.
So House Bill 344 establishes a sub-fund within the state treasury to better account for and track funds Alaska receives from national opioid litigation settlements. Over the interim, I was looking into the opioid problem and the needs and that is not just prevalent in Anchorage but across the state. Then shortly after I had started digging into the funds, I was listening to a legislative budget and audit meeting where the state auditor discussed a finding identifying an issue with funds that must be used for the abatement and remediation of opioid addiction in our communities. The issue was that these dollars had been incorrectly reported due to insufficient oversight, the absence of clear procedures, and the lack of a separate fund to track these settlement dollars. So while these funds are coming into the state with specific requirements for how they are to be used, we do not currently have a clear, consistent way to track and account for them. HB 344 is a fix that I worked on with the Department of Health to create a place for these funds and make our ability to track them clearer. So if the committee would like, if the chair would like, we could do our presentation or I could take questions.
Please go ahead with your presentation.
Yeah, for the record, Emily Durfee, staff to Representative Colombe. So HB 344 establishes a separate fund within the state treasury that is to deal with the monies that we're receiving from nationwide settlements that the state of Alaska participated in 2021 and 2022. These lawsuits were alleging that various opioid manufacturers and distributors were misleading doctors and patients about the risk of opioids and failing to detect or report suspicious orders and diversions of prescription opioids. The outcome of those settlements means that Alaska will be receiving about $100 million paid throughout the course of the next 16 years. And the settlement says that those funds have to be used for the abatement of the opioid crisis. So they have to be used for treatment and recovery services, prevention programs, community response efforts, and generally things that will help ease the problem. The settlements also require changes in how defendants were to monitor opioid distribution. But going forward to the fiscal year 2024 audit, there was a finding identifying a misrepresentation or misreporting of these funds. And as Representative Colombe said in her introduction, in part this was due to a lack of a separate fund to hold and track these monies. So HB 344 establishes the separate fund in the state treasury with the goal of directly responding to that legislative audit recommendation to improve transparency and financial tracking and to ensure that these settlement funds are used for opioid abatement efforts in Alaska. Do we have any questions from the committee?
Thank you for your presentation. Do we have any questions from the committee and available for questions? We also have Chris Curtis, legislative auditor, in the room, as well as Lindsay Cato, director of the Division of Public Health, who is available online. I have a question first for Chris Curtis. Could you just talk more about the audit findings related to the opioid funds and the difficulty that it makes for us as appropriators to be able to track those funds?
Certainly. For the record, I'm Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. So we audit the state's financial statements every year. And in the FY24 audit, we found that the state had received $11.1 million in FY23 and $12.3 million in FY24, and those monies were not correctly reported in the draft statements we received. So we corrected that via an audit adjustment. But what we found that contributed to that problem or those that misreporting was that the monies were being put into the general fund without sufficient accounting structures to be able to identify and report them correctly in the statements. And as we were doing research to figure out how to do the adjustment, we found the restrictions on the use of the funds. And so we recommended in part to create a separate fund. Now, you can do it a lot of different ways. You can create a subfund of the general fund. You can have a separate fund that would have its own column in the state's financial statements. And we believe this will help facilitate the proper reporting of those monies. Now, in FY25, we found that the state received $5.2 million. And again, they did not report them correctly in the draft statement. It wasn't material enough for us to have a recommendation in the single audit. But again, it just reinforced, we believe, the need for improved accounting structures to track that money and to report on compliance with the settlement terms.
What are the risks of the state being non-compliant with the settlement terms?
I cannot answer that. That's a non-accounting question.
I might ask that question maybe for Director Cato with the Division of Public Health. Do you have any idea what risks there are with the state if we are non-compliant with the different settlements?
For the record, this is Director Lindsay Cato for the Division of Public Health. Chair Mina, I would say that that's a question for law, who's been instrumental in kind of the building of the settlement and the final settlement agreement.
Thank you. And we do not have law on the line for this bill, but I will ask them later. I have another question for Director Cato. Has the Cato? Cato, my apologies. Director Cato, has the Department of Health been the main recipient of these funds, or have there been other state agencies or local governments that have also received opioid settlement funds?
Thanks. For the record, Lindsay Cato, Division Director for the Division of Public Health. Chair Mina, that's a great question. So I would clarify that the Department of Health, Division of Public Health, has been the only spender or distributor of the opioid settlement money. But we do not, at the Department of Health, collect that money directly. That has been between law and Department of Revenue. So we each year, some of you might remember, each year we come and present how we would like to spend those opioid settlement dollars and ask for that appropriation during the budget period during the state legislature. And then we are granted the appropriation to use those dollars underneath of the guidance of the Opioid Settlement Steering Committee, which is required by the final opioid settlement. I will say that 9 political subdivisions, which are defined in the settlement as political subdivisions that have 10,000 or more people, signed on to the settlement as well and received directly, not through the state of Alaska, their own settlement, which doesn't come through us and isn't distributed by us, but is distributed directly from the settlement administrator.
Thank you. Well, on that, for those 9 political subdivisions, this wouldn't be tracked in this bill with the opioid settlement fund. Is that correct?
You know, my understanding, for the record, Lindsay Cato, Division Director, Chair Mina, my understanding is that in those 9 political subdivisions who receive those dollars themselves account for those dollars and would need to set up their own funds. But again, I would defer to law for any additional information on that.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Representative Colombe and Ms. Durfee, for your presentation. At this time, we will set aside House Bill 344 for a future hearing. I'll take a brief at ease to transition to our last presentation. At ease. Back Back on the record, our last item today, we have House Bill 272 by Representative Andy Josephson on insurance coverage for prosthetics and orthotics. Representative Josephson and staff Aaron Page, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation?
Thank you, Chair Mina. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13, South Midtown.
And I'm Aaron Page, Staff to Rep. Josephson.
Thank you, committee, for hearing House Bill 272. I am very pleased and privileged to be here, and I'm grateful that you've calendared this bill. To the chair and for the record, as you heard, I'm Andy Josephson, and I heard about this bill last fall from at least one testifier who's with us today. We met with them. We vetted the bill, of course. And the essence of the bill is that we found that Medicaid and Medicare may be receptive to providing a prosthetic or orthotic to an individual in need of that device, those devices. But it's ambiguous to me, and we've gotten effectively a legal opinion from the Department of Health about whether those programs would cover more than one device. And that begs the question, why must there be more than one? But even if you find that, as to Medicaid and Medicare recipients, there's nothing that we can do short of, for example, a state plan amendment, we take the position that private insurance could be compelled statutorily to provide more than one prosthetic or orthotic. Why would this be good policy? I heard Ms. Bright, who I bet will testify shortly. We had a meeting with Senator Murkowski and this young man, Justice, for the record, that's J-U-S-T-U-S. And by the way, nod to Senator Murkowski. She was magnificent in her meeting. Very genuine. And what we've learned is that folks who need prosthetics and orthotics often need more than one. They may need one for recreational reasons. They may need one for hygienic reasons. Those are the two principal alternative reasons. As to the former, there could be value to this case, the patient or the recipient, but also to the insurance company, as Ms. Bright said so brilliantly to the senator, because the quality of their life is enhanced, their health is enhanced, and so it can be a win-win for all. So HB 272 is a low-cost, high-impact bill that will help all Alaskans live healthy, active lives. Currently, people with limb loss can generally expect their insurance, as I noted, whether private insurance, Medicaid, or Medicare, to approve coverage for a single device that lets them get through ordinary daily life. But often those devices can't handle the needs of an active life like running, skiing, or kayaking. And through today's witnesses and other sources, I've learned that coverage for an additional prosthetic suitable for exercise or even showering is often denied, and that at best such coverage is unpredictable and ambiguous. Additional prosthetics can be prohibitively expensive, and self-payment is out of reach for many. House Bill 272 specifies that people with limb loss and a standard prosthetic be covered for an additional prosthetic that lets them live an active, healthy life. The medically necessary qualification discussed in the bill must still be met, but insurers and providers are directed to consider the benefits of exercise, adequate hygiene, and improved mental health in that determination. I wanted to note that I was very involved in the drafting of the bill because I recall looking intensely, I think, at a New Mexico model, and I think it was a Minnesota model, but much of the language is designed to mirror those models. I have to return to House Finance shortly, but I'll try to answer any questions you have.
Do we have any questions from the committee for Representative Josephson, Representative Fields?
How quickly can we pass this bill? That's my only question. Thank you.
Great question. We'll continue with the full process to make sure that we give the bill its due diligence.
Okay.
Is that the sectional?
Sure.
Right. Buckle up. I'm here with the sectional analysis. All right. HB 272, activities.
Please put yourself on the record. Excuse me.
I'm Erin Page, staff to Andy Josephson, to the chair and for the record. This bill, HB 272, an act relating to insurance coverage for prosthetic and orthotic devices, relating to medical assistance for prosthetic and orthotic devices, and providing for an effective date. Section 1 amends AS 2142 to add Section 2142-445, which introduces requirements for prosthetic and orthotic coverage. Paragraph A specifies that insurance providers must provide coverage for prosthetic and orthotic devices to at least the level required by Medicare. Paragraph B requires that the coverage include all such devices determined by a healthcare provider to be most appropriate to meet the covered person's medical needs for a range of exercise and personal hygiene activities. Paragraph C specifies conditions for coverage of repair or replacement deemed necessary by a healthcare provider. Paragraph D addresses classifications needed to meet state or federal requirements of essential health benefits. Paragraph E requires that device coverage be covered to the same extent that medical or surgical intervention would be covered for a non-disabled person seeking to perform the same physical activity. Paragraph F addresses availability of in-network and out-of-network providers. Paragraph G forbids financial requirements that apply only to prosthetic and orthotic coverage and requires that cost-sharing requirements for prosthetics and orthotic devices be no more restrictive than the requirements for inpatient physician and surgical services. Paragraph H specifies requirements for notifying a covered person of their rights and providing written, detailed information on the reasons for a denial of a claim. Section 2 amends AS 4707030 parentheses B, to add orthotic devices and replacement devices to the list of optional Medicaid services provided by the state of Alaska. Section 3 contains reporting requirements for private insurers and state Medicaid. Section 4 amends uncodified law of the state of Alaska to specify that Section 1 applies to plans issued or renewed after the effective date. Section 5 requires the Department of Health to submit an update to the state plan to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And finally, Section 6 sets an effective date of January 1, 2027, conditional on the changes to the state plan being approved or deemed unnecessary.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill presenters? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor or staff. In Section 1B, when it says the coverage for prosthetic and orthotic devices required under this section must include all prosthetic or orthotic devices that the covered person's health care provider determines are the most appropriate, I mean, could it be six or seven prosthetic devices? How many prosthetic devices must be covered?
Through the chair, I take your point. I suspect we mirrored that language, as I said, on some sister states that had similar language. And what I've heard is that there are three models that a person may need. One would be a sort of sedentary day-to-day. Another one might be recreational or athletic. And a third might be hygienic. I haven't heard of a device other than that. I suspect for an athlete there could be some other adjustments that are needed, however. And the issue can get the principle is the same, but depending on, and this was discussed with Senator Murkowski, depending on which joints need to be covered, costs and need can vary.
Follow up. Thank you. I think, I guess my question is about that language and if there's any tightening up that could be done. Because if I were to imagine, I think most of the time it would never come up. But, you know, if you don't think about it, it could come up where somebody wanted one for sitting, one for bathing, one for swimming, one for running, one for travel. You know, they would want a variety, and they might have a provider who's like, yeah, let's get you all of them, and do you want an extra just in case you don't have one with you, you know, just keep in the car. I mean, and the law says it must be covered.
I think that Dr. Page, my staff, may want to contribute something more. Representative Gray, through the chair.
There are no explicit limits, but there are expectations that any provider will look at the medically necessary requirement and deem a particular device as acceptable for the range of activities that are needed. As the representative said, there are sort of three main areas, and our expectation is that with additional advice from potentially from prosthetists and others, we may be able to tighten up that language.
Thank you.
So. Any other questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? All right, I'll transition on to our invited testifiers. We have two invited testifiers in person and one on Teams. First, I'd like to invite Justine Bright from Anchorage up to the presenter's table. Oh, excuse me, I will reverse that. I will have Mr. Justice Bohart first to come up to the presenter's table. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. Is this on?
Yeah. It's on.
Okay. This is my leg. It's really good for walking and standing, but not so good for running and jumping.
Justice, could you say your name just for the record?
Yes.
Who you are?
I'm Justice Bohart from Seward, Alaska.
Perfect.
This is my prosthetic leg. It's really good for running and, it's really good for walking and standing, but not so good for running and jumping. This is the heel, and this is the toe part. And that's what makes it good for standing and walking. But for running, you need a blade that can jump. And you can't put both of them in one because they both are so different. This house bill would help me get a running leg and many other kids like me so we could all run and play with our friends.
Thank you, Mr. Bohart, and great job on your testimony. Do we have any questions for Mr. Bohart? Representative Fields.
Through the chair. Great job, Justice.
Thank you.
Being here.
Thank you for being here. We will now transition to our next invited testifier, Justine Bright. If you could also put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, committee. My name is Justine Bright. I'm from Anchorage. Thank you for your time today. I originally moved to Alaska to lead a trail crew in Lake Clark National Park in January 2023. I fell 43 feet in a climbing accident. I sustained a number of injuries that will never fully heal. One of those injuries, my crushed ankle, resulted in a bone infection, and I found myself choosing between either amputating my lower leg or fusing my ankle permanently with bone from my femur. Before my accident, I spent several years working as a wilderness trail crew member and spent my free time trail running, backpacking, and climbing. Both my physical and mental well-being were directly tied to the amount of time that I was spending in the mountains working or running. I joined the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group and was finishing basic training at the time of my accident. As I researched my surgery options, I talked with a number of amputees who had lifestyles similar to mine before my accident. And one of them was actually a wilderness ranger in Denali. And talking with them, I started to feel hopeful for the first time that I'd be able to do those activities that I love again, things that would be very difficult or impossible with a fused ankle but could be possible with amputation. However, the ranger warned me not to get my hopes up too much about getting the devices I would need because his prosthetic devices were covered by workers' compensation, and he knew that most insurance policies are not as likely to cover activity-specific devices like a running leg. So after that conversation, I started looking into this issue and was shocked to learn that so many amputees have to try to scrape together limited grants to raise money to get the device they need to be healthy and active, and are often forced to live without them. I couldn't believe that after going through something as life-changing as amputation or being born with congenital limb difference, the barrier to being active and healthy is not the physical challenge of learning how to walk or run again, not the trauma or the difficulty of healing from surgery, but it's merely the fact that many insurance policies do not provide the same access to function and health to the limb loss and limb difference community as they do to able-bodied individuals. I wanted to know if anyone was doing anything about this, so I found an article about this bill, So Everybody Can Move, passing in Colorado. I brought the idea and the bill to the woman who makes my prosthetics, Allison Kahn, and asked her if she thought there was a need for it in Alaska. And she said, absolutely. So together we reached out to the national organization that's been working on getting this bill passed in other states to see what it would take to bring this legislation to Alaska. I decided to go with the ankle fusion for now, partly because I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to get the devices I need if I went with amputation at that time. So I now use an ankle-foot orthotic brace for cross-country skiing, hiking, and weight training. And I've made it work, but I have had some pain and minor skin injuries from using that AFO with cross-country ski boots that it doesn't really fit into because Medicaid typically doesn't cover secondary orthotics. The brace helps a lot, but I haven't been able to return to backpacking or running due to the extra strain the impact puts on my knee and hip. So I would like to be able to help pack out a moose or hunt my own moose one year, but I don't believe that my knee or foot could handle the strain of that weight on uneven ground with the limitation of my ankle mobility. I still consider amputation as a possibility, and my decision hinges partly on whether or not we can pass this legislation. I have had 5 surgeries so far on my ankle, and I anticipate needing to have more to correct some of the issues that I continue to have with with my foot and the hardware in my leg. There are so many reasons that this bill is a no-brainer for Alaska. So first of all, we have data now from several states, 12 states where it's passed, and that demonstrates the related costs of passing this legislation are negligible. And the long-term healthcare savings is much greater because of that injury prevention, much healthier active lifestyles like we've talked about. We are providing published studies, actuarial statements, and memorandums written by lawyers from states where this bill has passed, asserting that this bill has immaterial cost and should not trigger cost of frail by the state because it meets ACA standards. The average cost difference found by those studies is estimated to be around 1 cent per member per month. We learned that the fiscal note depicts a cost of $250,000. Luckily, we know now from other states that usually if the estimate is that high, it's because it includes other types of durable medical equipment, and there might be an inaccurate estimation of the utilization of secondary devices. So if you're looking at the entire population of people who use orthotics and prosthetics in Alaska and assuming that they'll all want secondary or even third devices, that estimate is going to be much higher than in reality. It's usually a quarter to a third of people who would actually require a secondary device for their activities. Furthermore, as you know, we're hard on our bodies in Alaska. We use them for lots of things you don't really get to do in the lower 48. Hunting, fishing, boating, traveling through some of the wildest landscapes in the world. I fell in love with living here because I felt I had found a place of shared values, of self-reliance and local community support, exploration, and living close to the land. I want to be able to stay here and get what I need to continue to work in wild places and contribute to volunteer efforts like the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group. And I'd be devastated if I had to move to another state just because they have better healthcare coverage. But that is an option that I would be forced to consider and encourage others to consider if this bill doesn't pass. It's rare that legislative solutions to big hurdles are this straightforward and clear. There's no substantial cost to the state, insurance companies, or individuals. We're not asking for new or outlandish coverage. We're just clarifying current coverage to meet the standards already accepted by the VA and workers' compensation. And I'm happy to drive home the point about negligible cost and long-term savings until the cows come home. But at the same time, it feels a little degrading in a way to have to focus so entirely on that when, frankly, this is just the right thing to do. There should be no question that there's simply no other way to move forward. This population has been left behind in our state for no other reason than lack of awareness and initiative. So we need you to make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brett, for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, we'll move on. Oh, my apologies. Representative Schonke.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Sorry, I might need a tissue here. Thank you guys for your testimony. This is great. So just quickly, you noted there at the end workman's comp and VA. Could you describe a little bit more about maybe those systems as far as what multiple prosthetics look like for people covered under those?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure if it made it into the bill packet, but we have some documents from VA's insurance coverage that specify exactly what is meant by secondary devices, and they have an informational page that describes how medical providers determine whether or not a device meets the medical necessity standard, and explaining the need for secondary devices and how that improves patients' quality of life. If it's not in the bill packet, I will make sure that we get that sent over to you. We have a PDF of that document, and it's been really useful to be able to talk to people who have VA and workers' comp insurance that this is standard practice for. And Representative Gray, I think it also speaks to your question of how you can, if there's not a limit to how many devices are covered, how we know that that won't just kind of get out of control. And I think that's a very valid question. But having a little bit more of an understanding of the background of just the field of orthotics and prosthetics, I think would be helpful, because there aren't so many devices that would meet the medical necessity standard that it would be a concern that would be abused. Although, yeah, I understand where that question comes from, and this has been vetted by workers' comp and VA. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Would love to have some backup. So follow up, I guess. What happens when a prosthetic is made and it doesn't fit right? How does that work?
That's a great question. And actually, it's one of the points that we like to drive home too, that when insurance or anyone pays for a prosthetic device, all of the care that's related to that specific device is then covered by that initial payment. So when a patient goes back in to get an adjustment, have something altered slightly, that the cost of that appointment is covered by the initial cost of that device.
I was thinking in the terms of, so I had a young friend that had a prosthetic and it didn't fit right, like his initial one, and they had to remake a whole separate prosthetic. How would this, or I guess the current situation right now, would it cover the cost of a second one just if it really didn't work right, or it related, you know, it gave you problems?
It's a good question, and I will have Allison maybe respond. Allison Kahn is the CPO, Certified Prosthetist Orthotist, who is also working with me on this legislation, so I make sure I'm not answering inaccurately. But my understanding is that typically when it's just adjustments, even if they do have to make substantial changes to the device, they're able to use most of the original materials, and that would be covered by the cost of the device. If there was, for some reason, an entirely new device that needed to be made, then that, I think that might be more of a case-by-case basis thing.
Okay, super. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For sure. We do have one more invited testifier, so I might transition to our last testifier, and then we can go back to Representative Schwanke's question and go to some of our other individuals available for question. Our last testifier for House Bill 272 is Patrick Reinhardt, Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. If you could put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Patrick Reinhardt. I am in Anchor Point, Alaska. I'm the Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Council, who has taken a position very much in support of HB 72, but I'm also a lifetime wearer of a prosthetic foot. First, I want to thank Representative Josephson for sponsoring the legislation and this committee, and Chair Mina for hearing it today for the first time. You heard from Justice and Justine, and their stories and needs for this legislative fix are very real. Back in May, they brought this issue to our council and made their case to us, just as they have done today, pointing out the short-sightedness of insurance companies limiting their customers to only one prosthetic or orthotic device at a time, which can put their health, safety, and wellness of those that need them at risk. My journey with prosthetics started over six decades ago. I was born without most of my right foot. And from a very early age, I had to have a prosthesis so I could walk around and walk and run around. For most of my young life, my prosthetics were made from leather, wood, and metal. I went through them about every 6 months to a year when I was young. And I had strict instructions from my parents with my prosthesis. A, don't get them wet. And B, do not kick footballs. This last one really irked me because I grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I had dreams of being a place kicker for the Green Bay Packers someday. And I had this dream because when I was young, there was a a football player by the name of Tom Dempsey. He was a field goal kicker for the New Orleans Saints, who for 43 years held the record, NFL record, for the longest field goal ever kicked. And he had a foot exactly like mine. But he had a specialized prosthesis made for kicking footballs straight on versus a soccer-style kick, and that's why he was able to kick them so far. But I could not get a secondary prosthesis. I could not be the next Tom Dempsey coming up through the ranks because my parents couldn't afford a secondary device, and the insurance wouldn't cover it then. I really thought this was going to be a path for me. Well, it wasn't. So as I got older, I really got into downhill skiing and cross-country skiing. And my prosthetics were never very good for that either. When I came to Alaska, I got involved with Challenge Alaska as a ski racer. And at first and later on, I became the director. But for years, I had to use my prosthesis, kind of like Justice. You only get one. And I had to try to use it for skiing. And they never worked very good. At times, I would just literally duct tape my leg into a ski boot and try to ski down a race course. And it didn't work very well for me. I had many high-speed wipeouts, and believe me, and I had many injuries because of having poor prosthetics for skiing. My insurance company at the time, they never had a problem fixing my broken back. They never had a problem fixing torn ligaments in my knee. It was at far more expense than a secondary prosthetic would have cost me. So today, these prostheses, you know, they're made of high synthetic materials. They last pretty well. I'm allowed to get one every 5 years. I have pretty good insurance with the state of Alaska, but I'm still limited to one every 5 years. At my age, I have a bunch of old ones. The ones that I could keep, and I modify sometimes. I cut them up into pieces. I put them back together for different things that I might need. And I even now have a ski prosthesis, having taken an old one and modified it, giving a 15-degree cant so I can downhill ski and much better than I did in my early years. Like I said, these things, you know, each one costs about $10,000, and they're not. For me, at least that's kind of what it's been for the last couple of decades. You know, that's not something that I can easily pull out of my pocket if I have to buy a secondary device. So I really, really feel for these young people here today, Justice and Justine. I would hate to see them go through life having to worry about whether or not they can have the right prosthesis to have an active, healthy lifestyle that, you know, we in Alaska kind of take for granted, just being able to enjoy the great outdoors here. So I hope we can do what other states have done, like Colorado and New Mexico was mentioned, and fix this error now. The research materials that were provided to you in your package shows that the cost is negligible to insurers, but it does a whole lot of good for the people that really could use a secondary device. Thank you for hearing this bill. We look forward to seeing this legislation move quickly to the legislature, starting with your support here of HB 272. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart, for your testimony. Do we have any questions for Mr. Reinhart? All right, I'll open it up to see if we have any further questions for the bill sponsor staff or invited testifiers. And I want to note that we also have available for questions Allison Kahn, prosthetist in Anchorage, Director Heather Carpenter with the Division of Insurance, and Tricia Skitt, Medicaid Program Specialist at the Division of Healthcare Services, on the phone. I have a question on the bill. I believe it's Section 3. This might be for Dr. Aaron Page. There's reporting requirements on the claims related to these devices for private insurers and state Medicaid. I think first off, if I could get a bit of context for where that reporting comes from, is if that's similar to other states' legislation.
It is similar to other states.
Please put yourself on the record.
I'm Erin Page, for the record. My apologies. That is modeled on other states also as an effort for us to understand what the actual expenses of this have been.
Yeah, this is Justine Bright for the record. I just wanted to add to that because it is an important piece. The part of the reporting requirement for insurance companies is just that they are required to share, if there is a denial, why, what the justification is for that denial, so that if they're denying a prosthetic, we can understand, is it just because it's for activity specific, or is there some other reason that they've deemed it's not medically necessary? So it's just a way of holding them accountable as well.
Thank you. Do we have other questions from the committee? Representative Schwanke?
Yeah, through the chair. I don't know who might best be the person to answer this, but how does current insurance work with youth in as you're growing? And do we know?
Yeah, I can answer that, and then maybe Allison could also jump in if she has anything to add. So the limit of 3 to 5 years is pretty typical for adults, and for children, that limit is typically a shorter period of time depending on their age. And otherwise, it's very similar for adults in terms of insurance covers repairs as long as the cost of the repair is 50% or less of the cost of a replacement.
Cool. Thank you.
And Miss or Dr. Khan, if you also have any additional comment on that.
Sure, yeah. So as far as the children and growth goes, I would say for the most part, the insurance companies are very reasonable with justifying if a child has grown, if we can show weight change and size change and quantifiable differences. They are due for new componentry and not so much held to those timelines that the adults are held to. The clarification is needed when it comes to additional devices at the same time, as opposed to requiring a new device because of growth.
Thank you. I have another question for Director Carpenter with the Division of Insurance. I know we talked a little bit about the cost savings in other states, and cost savings aren't always reflected in fiscal notes. So I would love for you to help talk through the current $225,000 plus fiscal note that we have with the bill.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. In particular, the reason we had to reflect a fiscal note is we do believe we will be subject to defrayal. And that occurs when benefits are beyond the requirements in the Affordable Care Act. So it is 45 CFR 155.170, and it applies to any mandate added by a state after December 31st, 2011, that goes beyond the established EHB benchmark plan. CMS has changed, or I should say, how they enforce that over the years. Sometimes they're a little bit more flexible. Currently, they are not. And there is a proposed rule that is in the Notice of Benefits and Payment Parameters. Those are the rules that CMS puts out every year for our fully insured plans that we need to follow. That rule has not been finalized yet for 2027. We did submit some public comment, so have other states, but it would require states to defray any state mandate, so anything in statute that is beyond, passed after that 2011 threshold, even if it is in our essential health benefits. So this is our best estimate of what we think that would cost. It is really hard to reflect what we think those increased savings might be. I don't doubt what the great testifier shared about, you know, improved health, but the division had to estimate what that cost of defrayal would be for our members, because we will actually have to pay our insurers in the individual market and small group market for the cost of these extra devices.
Thank you. Ms. Bright, would you like to comment?
Yeah, this is Justine Bright for the record. I do want to add to that we have a document written by a number of lawyers who specialize in economic matters of defrayal and whether or not this triggers defrayal. I just want to send that to you all so that you can decide for yourselves, because it is up to the state to determine whether or not whether this triggers defrayal. And we have people who've done research that supports the decision not to trigger defrayal. And most of the states that have passed this bill have gone that route. I think Tennessee is one of the exceptions where defrayal was triggered, or they made that determination.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Through the chair, could I ask Ms. Carpenter a follow-up? Can we assert that this doesn't trigger defrayal and see if CMS challenges it? Is that an option?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. Through the chair, Representative Fields. I would be worried about that, trying that route. I think our insurers could, push back. They could potentially file litigation against the division for not covering that. And I do think the recent stance by CMS kind of really doubling down on how they're interpreting requirements of defrayal does change how the division is looking at this.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, thank you so much to our invited testifiers and for our bill sponsor for coming before the committee today. At this time, we are setting aside House Bill 272 for a future hearing. That concludes our agenda for today's committee. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, April 2nd at 3:15 p.m. in Davis 106. The time is 4:53 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.